There was a report in the newspaper last week of a professor in California, where else, who wants to produce a race of genius by selective breeding. I don't know if you saw it. He's inviting Nobel Prize winners to participate in eugenic experiments by cross-fertilizing the world's best minds. He hopes to obtain children of hitherto unparalleled IQ levels. It all sounds very sinister to me, echoes of the Nazi master race and Huxley's Brave New World ring in my ears when people say things like that. Mercifully, the success of the plan depends totally on the degree to which human intelligence is controlled by heredity, and there's no clear consensus on that controversial question at the moment. Hopefully, he will find that his geniuses are more elusive than he expects. But, you know, even if the experiments do succeed in producing infant prodigies by the score, I hope that learned man doesn't seriously think he's found the solution to all world problems by his genetic meddling. According to the Bible, history itself has exposed the futility of that hope. Because thousands of years ago, the Bible tells us the world became so corrupt, so evil, that God pronounced a judgment of total extermination on the whole human race. Only one family, one carefully selected gene pool remained. A righteous man, a spiritual man, as near perfect a man as the world had ever seen, Noah is his name. And from the seed of that single man, God determined to repopulate the entire globe. Now, if ever utopia was going to arrive as a result of genetic engineering, surely this was it. Genesis 9 begins full of possibility. Noah, like a second Adam, steps out of the ark into the pristine purity of a new world from which every trace of wickedness has been judicially purged. The rainbow, sign of God's peace treaty with man, embraces the horizon. Surely we think now at last man would find his way back to the Garden of Eden, that paradise he'd so foolishly forfeited. And yet, you know, within a few verses, all our fond hopes are smashed in pieces. Just look back at chapter 9, verse 20 and following. Noah, a man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard. When he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers. Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders, walked in backward and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces turned the other way so they would not see their father's nakedness. And when Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan." It's possible, of course, to draw moralizing conclusions from this strange incident about the evils of alcohol. Certainly there have been countless others since Noah to find strong drink was their ruin, Georgie Best not the least. But you know, that whole line of thinking really misses the whole point. What we have here really is an ironic parallel to that story of the fall with which Genesis began. Adam, remember, fell by eating the fruit of a tree. Noah here falls by drinking the fruit of the vine. Adam discovered the treachery of the serpent among God's creation. Noah discovers the treachery of the grape among God's creation. Both, as a result of their mistake, are humiliated by the exposure of their nakedness. Both end up with the harmony of a perfect world spoiled and dislocated by a curse. It's an ironic recapitulation of Adam's experience. The difference, of course, is that in Noah's case, God takes no direct hand in the proceedings at all. Adam had eaten of the tree God planted, but Noah ate of his own. Adam's nakedness was covered by God's initiative, but Noah's by his own children. Adam's judgment was pronounced by God, but Noah here delivers his own curse. For you see, this is not a second fall. It's that old fall
rearing its ugly head again like some phoenix out of the Holocaust of Judgment. The flood hadn't exorcised the demon in man at all. Sin was still there in the world, inherent, implicit, built into the structures of human personality and human relationship. God had promised that he would not curse the world again. But then he didn't have to. Left to himself, fallen man would quickly curse it for him. And Noah did. You see what it all means? Sin is not a single gene that can be bred out of the human race by careful selection. It's a corruption that permeates every department of the human personality. No one is immune, not even righteous Noah. And this story is recounted to show us that even within the man God calls good, there is that same root of self-indulgence, that same inclination to abuse God's creation, that led to Adam's shame. Amongst his sons, there is that same mixture of honor and dishonor that led to Cain's alienation. Genesis 9, that begins so bright with optimism, ends with the same sad old story of brothers divided by a curse. The flood had been a judgment against sin, all right, but it hadn't been a remedy, had it? Like radical surgery, it had reduced the tumor, but it hadn't eradicated its malignancy. The symptoms are still there, unmistakable, sinister. Perhaps if you've been following the series, you remember when Cain left home after he murdered his brother, he sought refuge in urban community. Do you remember that? So maybe it ought not to surprise us that within a few generations, Noah's descendants are doing just the same. Come, they said, let us build ourselves a city. And today we're going to study the fate of that city. They called it Babel then, but you probably know it better by its later name of Babylon. You'll see the outline of our study in three sections on the white bulletin. First of all, man's ambition in verses 1 to 4. Secondly, heaven's foreboding in verses 5 to 6. And then God's remedy, verses 7 to 10. Let's look first at man's ambition. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar, we read, and settled there. The beginnings of a Neolithic culture in the Near East had been on the highland steeps of Armenia, but archaeology confirms that with the commencement of the Bronze Age, an important new centre of civilization developed in the flood plains between the rivers in southern Mesopotamia, the land of Sumer, or Shinar, as it's called here. But there's no difficulty in anchoring this story in concrete, factual context. It's history, not pious myth we're reading here. Nevertheless, having said that, I can't resist the thought that this observation about men moving eastwards has got more than geographical significance. You see, we read in chapter 2, verse 8, that God had planted the Garden of Eden in the east. And then in chapter 3, verse 24, when he drove men out of that garden, he drove them out, we read, on the east side. And then in 4, verse 16, when Cain was banished after the murder of his brother, we read, he migrated to the land of wandering in the east. Here then is just one more step in the same direction. A humanity moving progressively further and further away from God and God's paradise. The flood had interrupted that movement, but it hadn't changed its trend. Man was still committed to a search for his own alternative, secularized utopia, east of Eden. Babel, in many ways, is simply the archetypal symbol throughout the whole of the Bible of that godless ambition. There are, in fact, in the aspirations of these migrants of Shinar, some disturbingly contemporary ring to what they say. This enthusiasm for technological innovation, for instance. You notice that? Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly, they say. See, man made in the image of God didn't lose his distinctive creative capacity in the form. Confronted by the challenge of this new environment, he doesn't need to wait like the animals do for evolution to adapt him. He can self-consciously adapt himself. If there's no rock, he will bake mud bricks. If there's no mortar, he'll use tar. And how childishly pleased he is with himself when he finds that his improvisations are actually improvements on his previous engineering techniques. New technology sparks off all kinds of exciting ideas in his fertile imagination. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower that reaches to heaven. So you see, man's scientific discoveries become the prelude to cultural revolution and economic development, new cities, new architecture, new civilizations. We're familiar with such quantum leaps in human history. They've occurred many times in the past, most recently in the Industrial Revolution in the 18th century. And I think many people believe that we're on the brink of such a dramatic new advance today. But there's nothing wrong in it, is there? Didn't God tell Adam to subdue the earth? Surely that's all these architects of Babel were doing, using their unique intellectual gifts as men to master their environment. Well, yes, that's true enough. The Bible never suggests there's anything essentially wrong in technological progress, does it? Man's ability to design and build is God-given. But what does man build? And why does he build it? That's the question this incident asks. See, the forge that produces the plow can also shape the gun, can't it? The pen that writes poetry can also write pornography. The chisel that carves a great sculpture can also fashion idols. Man's technique can deprave as well as ennoble him. The constructs of his imagination are not necessarily good because they're clever. Now, there's plenty in these verses to indicate that Babel, for all its technological achievement, and all that maybe we want to identify with in the 20th century in that technological achievement, it's nevertheless an expression of man's rebellion against God, rather than any genuine attempt to fulfill the cultural mandate. I mean, take this tower, for instance. You know, there are really only two reasons for such a construction. One is warfare. Towers were conventional means of defense. There is, in fact, a strong hint in chapter 10, in the middle, around verses 8 and 10, that Babel was just one of four fortified cities which controlled the whole of the Mesopotamian basin under the tyranny of one man, Nimrod, the mighty warrior. It may well be that the events of chapter 11 ought to be inserted chronologically into chapter 10 at that point, so that the desire to build this city was in fact just part of a general ambition to found world empire around Nimrod's military genius. And that might also cast some light on this strange expression in verse 4, that we may make a name for ourselves. It's tempting for us, I suppose, to interpret that phrase as if its meaning were identical to the parallel English idiom. To us, to make a name for yourself means to become famous. And that sense need not be excluded, but undoubtedly, in a Middle Eastern context, a name meant more than simply renown. To give something a name was to define its identity, and therefore, in some respects, to assert authority over it. Maybe you remember when God brought to Adam the animals for him to categorize and label, to name, as token of his dominion. Of course, the normal way for a human being to receive a name is through his parents. And that had been certainly so up to this point in history. A name, in chapter 10, implies that man belongs to a family. And it was to that family he owed his primary loyalty. But what we're seeing here in Babel, you see, is an attempt for a man to form a new kind of social solidarity, a group of immigrants defining their own name, not on the basis of kinship, but of geographical location. Let us make a name for ourselves that we may not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Put it bluntly, we may be seeing here the transition from tribalism to what we would probably call nationalism today. Indeed, if you couple this appeal to the land, to patriotism, with their pride in their language and the collectivist mentality of their building program and their enthusiasm for technological advance and the expansionist militarism of their dictator, it all reminds me more than a little of the zeitgeist of Nazi Germany. Maybe that's fanciful. But certainly one interpretation of verse 4 is to see it as a reflection of the birth of a nationalist psychology, the organic state, to which men willingly sacrifice their individual identity. Hitler told men to be German or else, and maybe Nimrod said they were to be Babylonian or else. The other alternative is that this tower wasn't designed for purposes of warfare, but for purposes of worship. We know from archaeological investigations that Sumerian culture developed a very distinctive style of temple, the ziggurat, technically called. It was a pyramidal tower built in tiers. Possibly the Sumerians missed the highland terrain from which they had originally migrated when they got to this flat Shinar plain. So they used their new technology to make a kind of artificial mountains remind them of it. It's tempting to surmise that this Tower of Babel was a prototype of that kind of ziggurat. And if so, that may shed light on that phrase in verse 4, a tower that reaches to heaven. But of course, the point of a ziggurat was that on its topmost pinnacle you put a religious shrine. The idea being that the tower provided a platform high enough off the ground to make contact with God. Tower to reach heaven. If the Tower of Babel was a construction like that, then it represents man's age-old endeavour to set up his own ladder to God. The Pharisee tries to do it by the ladder of moral achievement. The Hindu by the ladder of mystical experience. The Greek by the ladder of intellectual philosophy. Well, these ancient Babylonians preferred a ladder of the most obvious and physical kind. But there was no difference in principle. Whatever sort of ladder it is, the Bible outlaws them all as presumptuous and futile. No man by searching will find God for himself. The only ladders set up between God and man are those that come down out of heaven. There isn't enough bricks in this whole universe to build one from this side of the spiritual divide. So whether we see this as a symbol of militaristic nationalism or of idolatrous paganism, there was no good reason for this tower. Whatever its precise purpose, it was most certainly an obelisk to human pride. Do you notice the repetition of that reflexive pronoun? Let us build ourselves a city. Let us make a name for ourselves, they said. This is man doing his own thing. Glory to man in the highest, he's the master of things, said the Tower of Babel. Now, to be sure, the flood had not taught man much, had it? That old arrogance was mushrooming again in defiance of God, just as it had done in the pre-diluvian world. And that brings us to the second section in our study, heaven's foreboding. Verse 5, but the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the men were building. See, as hard as man tries to build his world independent of God, there really is no way you can lock the Lord of the universe out. He has a very inquisitive disposition as far as we human beings are concerned. He keeps all our activities under very close scrutiny, does God. And he's not above interfering in our affairs, if that suits him. That's why it's so futile, really, trying to build without reference to him. Sooner or later, he's bound to make his presence felt, maybe bring our enterprise to a full stop prematurely. Perhaps you, like the builders of Babel, have been pursuing your ambition. Maybe you, like them, feeling thoroughly pleased with your achievement. You're really doing quite well. Quite a success story, your life, is it? What do you need to think about God for? Well, no reason at all, really, except that he's thinking very hard about you. He's looking into your future. He's extrapolating the present trends of your life to see what sort of destiny you are fashioning for yourself. He's doing that right now, as he was doing it for these dwellers of Babel. And if what he sees disturbs him as much as his premonition regarding these Babylonians did, then you are in for trouble. The Lord said, if as one people, speaking the same language, they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Now, isn't that an extraordinary comment to come from the lips of God? Nothing impossible. Does God really mean it? Has he really invested such dreadful potential in man? Well, he should know if anybody does, shouldn't he? Conservative-minded Christians, you know, I think often respond quite wrongly to the claims of humanism. They hear these eminent scientists surmising that one day soon man will visit the stars or create life from inorganic materials or build a computer with self-conscious personality or something like that, and they say, no, 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 it'll never happen, it's impossible. Only God can do those sort of things. Proud man has just got a grossly inflated opinion of his abilities. I tell you, no. Humanists have not underestimated man's technological competence. If man sets his mind unitedly and determinedly on a goal, he can achieve anything. God says so. The difference is that whereas that thought excites the humanist, it horrifies heaven. Nothing they do will be impossible to them. What on the lips of a humanist will be a glowing testimony of optimism about man's glorious future becomes, you see, on the lips of God, a grim foreboding of tragedy and disaster. For God knows what a dreadful responsibility omnipotence is. He's utterly realistic about how woefully irresponsible the human heart is. I think it was Lord Acton, wasn't it, who said that power corrupts. Well, it may do, but in man's case it doesn't have to. He's corrupt already. All that power does is to render the expression of that corruption all the more hideous and destructive. Technological development, you see, is not the unqualified blessing our 20th century assumes. Because technology gives power, and man is simply not good enough to wield that power safely. That's why the more and more our technology grows, the more insecure we become. God saw it all long ago, implicit in that tower of these Babylonians, and he decided to do something about it. That brings us to the remedy. Look at verse 7. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. The origins of human language are very imperfectly understood, actually. Many linguistic experts would want to question whether all the known world languages could possibly derive from a date as recent and a location as narrow as this story suggests. Nevertheless, I think it's very important to realize on the other side that there is a deep mystery about the diversity of human language. And there's no way any evolutionary theory can explain it easily. There are many identifiable language groups, but the distribution of those groups doesn't parallel in any simple way ethnic or geographical division in the human race. When I lived in Africa, not infrequently, you could encounter a dozen quite different languages within a radius of 100 miles. A Babel dispersion, such as Genesis suggests, whatever its difficulties, is far from being an unreasonable explanation of many observations of that kind. The Lord scattered them from there, we read, over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. linguistic diversity, you see, was only incidental in the purpose of God. What he was really after was stopping that city. Many commentators treat this dispersion as if it were a judgment of God, but there's no indication in the text of that, is there? We don't read that God was angry, simply that he was concerned about where man's foolish charge towards technological achievement was going to lead him. It was an act of mercy, perhaps, rather than retribution, rather like a wise father who will check his baby when he sees him running towards a fire. So God diverted man's energies from his suicidal course. Having said that, I think there's no doubt that confusing man's language was a much more serious measure than perhaps it seems to us on the surface reading it. We're beginning in our day to understand that languages differ not just superficially in vocabulary, but in their syntax, and even more fundamentally in the philosophy and the logic and the worldview which they presuppose. Language doesn't simply express our thoughts, it actually shapes them, controlling the way we actually comprehend things by its structure. So you see, by diversifying men's languages, God was introducing into the world a most profound communication barrier. Man would no longer understand one another. And in a way that went far beyond anything which translation or learning Esperanto could remedy. For men would no longer think the same way. The aspirations and the values and the culture would diverge with their language. They would not want the same sort of world as one another anymore. There would no longer be a universal consensus about truth. And so distrust, disagreement, competition. It was all very regrettable. But it did mean that the technological revolution would progress much more slowly. They stopped building the city, says our text. World empires would still arise, of course. Looking back at chapter 10, verse 11, it seems likely that Nimrod, having been frustrated in Mesopotamia, went off and started a new urban development up in Assyria. But such empires would be short-lived, for other nations vying for supremacy, for their culture, would collide. And in the collision, cultural impetus would be lost. It's like radiotherapy on a tumour, if you like. Harm would be done to good, as well as malignant aspects of human development. Great achievements would be lost, perhaps irrecoverably. But in the wisdom of God, it was better that way than let the power of fallen man escalate unchecked. Better a world confused, says God, than a society which is single-mindedly going the wrong way. See, you can't talk about progress till you know where you're supposed to be going. What are the lessons of this extraordinary story then for us today? I think there are several we ought to think about. I think first there's a lesson of guidance to those of us who may think about and be involved in politics. You know, we're often disappointed that the world is so divided. We complain of lack of international understanding, that the United Nations are so disunited, that the common market has so little in common. Even within nations, separatist groups struggle for regional autonomy, violently perhaps. And it's tragic. It blocks the way so effectively to all our utopian dreams of peace and prosperity. And yet, you know, in the hidden counsels of God, those tensions may well be much more of a blessing in disguise than we think. We ought not to naively accept the world's understanding of those things. For you see, there are still plenty of imperialistic Nimrods who, given half a chance, would love to conquer the world and homogenize its culture to their own taste. Anxious as we are to be peacemakers, there is a price that's too great to pay for peace. We ought to resist those who, thinking themselves wiser than God, want to artificially reverse the Babel decree in the name of world universe, world unity. For diversity is good for man, even though it makes an international understanding more difficult. Diversity is good for man. World government, world economy, one world language may all sound very fine and wonderful in theory, but its potential for evil would be catastrophic. That's what 1984, of course, and Brave New World understood so well. A lesson, then, for us to think about in regard to our politics there. I think there's another line of instruction, too, in this story, for all of us who are involved in technology one way or another. See, Babel represents a watershed in man's cultural development. Technological innovation was going to revolutionize his world. That's the situation that Babel represents. And many believe we're on the brink of a very similar new phase in human progress today. Marshall McLuhan calls it the electric era. Brzezinski prefers the adjective technitronic. Harvey Cox calls it technopolitan. Bernard Gross calls it the mobiletic revolution. So you see, our secular prophets are straining the language to express the novelty of the age upon the threshold of which we're standing. The industrial revolution of the 18th century is going to be nothing, they tell us, compared with the transformation that will come upon post-industrial society. Sir George Thompson, the physicist and Nobel Prize winner, suggests that not since the invention of agriculture itself at the commencement of the Neolithic age has man stood on the brink of such momentous changes. And you know, one of the most significant and interesting things about this particular technological revolution that we are involved in is the centrality of advances in communication. Isn't that interesting? Marshall McLuhan, in his early writings, at any rate, comments very enthusiastically about the possibility of the way the media are going to transform our world into a what he calls global village. And there are many who look forward to a reunification of the human race by means of that kind of technological revolution. But I suggest to you, we need to be deeply suspicious of such aspirations. Our modern technocratic age is altogether too much like Babel for comfort. Did you know one modern paraphrase actually renders a tower that reaches up to heaven by the word skyscraper? To make that plain. The humanist and the Marxist may put their trust for the future in technological advance, but the Christian ought to know better than to engage in those foolish utopian dreams. Babel is not the way. And that brings us to the third lesson I think we must learn from this story, which is a word of hope for all of us, for man at the end of the 20th century. See, though there may be a few who are dreadfully enthusiastic about the possibility of a global village and a technological revolution, I think it's true to say that the vast majority of people in our society are very anxious about it. There is a deep gnawing despair in our contemporary world as a result of our obsession with technological progress. Nigel Calder wrote a few years ago, "The inability of the human species to make discriminating use of science induces a sense of helplessness in us. The impression is that we are passengers in a runaway cab and no one is in the driving seat." 1955, Bertrand Russell and Albert Einstein issued a joint manifesto. It was in fact delivered just a couple of days before Einstein died. One of the sentences in that is this: "We have found that men who know most are the most gloomy." Perhaps you, like me, when I first read this story, feel that the story of Babel is a rather unsatisfying reply to that kind of deep modern anxiety. God's action here in confusing men's languages seems to have been very much a stopgap measure, doesn't it? They may have stopped building the city then, but they went on building it elsewhere, and they're certainly building it again now, all around us. What trick does God have up his sleeve for the next time man's overweening technology threatens to claim omnipotence? Now you know the answer to that seems almost laughable. You'll find it in verse 10 of chapter 11. This is the account of Shem. Now that's a silly verse, isn't it? After all this dramatic business about the Tower of Babel, to suddenly descend to the banal. And yet you know, when you see it in the light of the whole Bible, that verse is the most significant in this whole chapter. You're right, Babel's confusion was a stopgap, nothing more. God knew that sooner or later man's arrogance would reach crisis point again. The diversification of language was simply a preemptive blow to forestall that eventuality, to ensure that it came later rather than sooner. Put it bluntly, God is playing for time here in chapter 11. Because, you see, he had a plan. He'd always had it, a plan of salvation, he called it, and we have to read the whole Bible to get a grasp of it. Unlike Noah's Ark, this plan would rescue out of the jaws of his divine anger not just a single family, but an innumerable multitude out of every nation. It was a fantastic scheme, so lofty in its conception, we read, even the angels had no idea of it. We read it was a secret purpose hidden within the secret counsels of the Godhead. But it was a very long-term project. It needed time. And God intervened at the Tower of the Babel to give the world that time. Time for what? 2 years after the flood, Shem was 100 years old. He became the father of Arpaxad. After he became the father of Arpaxad, Shem lived 500 years and had other sons and daughters. When Arpaxad lived 35 years, he became the father of Shelah, and so on. We could go on. It's a long list, isn't it? But it's there, you see. So you realize why God needed time. Time for the plan. Century after century after Babel, the divided nations would go their own way. God would not interfere with them again. He wouldn't have to. He checked their immediate danger. From now on, his interest would focus down on a single family amongst all those scattered peoples, a little clan of Semites, insignificant, almost unheard of. The Lord said to Abram, "Leave your country, your people, your father's household, and go to the land I will show you." See, it's here, in this promise to Abraham, that the Bible finds the ultimate answer to man's need for hope. Through the descendants of this man's body, the scattered nations would find their reunion. Through his seed, the curse would be lifted, and men would discover again the blessing of God. Abraham began his life in a city, a Mesopotamian city, ironically enough, Ur. Archaeologists tell us it had a particularly fine ziggurat, but that's probably just a coincidence. What isn't coincidence, I'm quite sure, is the direction in which Abraham's pilgrimage was directed. You know where God sent him. He sent him west. Not east. Now, at last, man's drift away from paradise had been reversed. You see, Abraham was not looking for another Babel. Babel is the city man builds. But the New Testament tells us Abraham was looking for a different city altogether, a city with foundations, whose builder and maker is God. And that's the Bible's final answer to Babel. It comes right at the very end of these many pages that are in our hands today. When John the prophet, on his exiled Isle of Patmos, sees a vision of the future. And in that future he sees Babel once again, in all its pride and affluence, and he sees it fall. "Woe, woe, a great city," he says. "In 1 hour you have been brought to ruin. Yet with the fall of Babel, he sees also another city. I saw New Jerusalem, the holy city, coming down out of heaven, prepared like a bride adorned for her husband. See, in a sense, the Bible has no answer to the doom mongers of our 20th century, with all their fears about ecological disaster and population explosions and the rest. The Bible has no answer to that. The Bible shares the fear which they express about the impotence of fallen man to make technology his salvation. Babel is doomed to collapse. All man's self-constructed utopias will fall. But there is hope. There is hope. But it is not a man-centered hope. If you want a life that's going somewhere, take my advice. Don't invest it in Babel. Babel is going to hell in a handcart. Look for that other city, the one Abraham was journeying towards, the city that man does not build, but which comes down from heaven on the last day. Fix your attention on that. There is no need for any proud tower to reach up to heavens in that city. For God is in the midst of her. He is her temple, and he is her fortress. And you and I are invited to walk in her streets. Will you come with me? Let's pray together.